Cliff Central.
The revolution.
I've got something important to tell you.
CliffCentral.com.
So I think the biggest myth about vulnerability is that it's weakness. I think a lot of people were raised to believe that. It was modeled, I think, certainly in our culture. We see that a lot, that to be vulnerable, to be open, to be exposed is to be weak. And the truth is, you know, what I found in my research is that vulnerability is not weakness. In fact, I would argue that it's our greatest measure of courage. When we went out and asked people, what is vulnerability? We heard things like, vulnerability is the first date after my divorce. Vulnerability is starting my own company. Vulnerability is taking responsibility for something that went wrong at work. Vulnerability is sitting with my wife who has stage 3 breast cancer and making plans for our young kids. Vulnerability is taking my business public. You know, the definition I use in my work of vulnerability is simply uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure. Vulnerability is about the willingness to show up and to be seen, even when there are no guarantees. It's pretty powerful when I have 13,000 pieces of data collected over 12 years that I cannot find a single incident or story of courage that was not completely underpinned by vulnerability. I think the problem arises that there's so many little paradoxes with vulnerability, and one of them is that vulnerability is courage in you, but weakness in me. When I meet you, it's the first thing I look for in you, but it's the last thing I want to show you in me. And so I think to really put ourselves out there, knowing that if we do that enough, we're going to fail, I just don't think it gets more courageous than that.
Hello, hello, hello. Hello, Algonoma Kinos. Hello. Welkom. Sani Bonani Molweni, Dumelang.
Oh, bonjour, bonsoir.
Welcome to the Meditations with Cliff Central. I'm here with my beautiful co-host, Lisa Cindy.
Oh, I'm here with my beautiful co-host, Mbalin Jomane.
Thank you very much, Lisa. today, we decided to change the pace a little bit, and, you know, we've done a lot so far, and we thought, you know, it's time to reflect on the progress we've made. The process has evolved so much. We've done shows that we never thought we would, and you guys have been along for the ride. So we thought we owe you an explanation of sorts on the inner workings of this process. I think for about, how many shows have we done?
I think about 21 or 22.
That's deep, right? Because when we first engaged Cliff Central, it was to do 10 shows.
Yeah.
Right?
Not even on air. We just wanted to, like, test the waters and see what they thought.
And lo and behold, here we are 11 shows after that.
Yeah.
I know how we've done it.
I don't know either.
But certainly not what we were anticipating. And it's kind of been like, it's been a good thing, you know, because we had a vision for what we wanted to do and it was finite. Mm. And I think through the course of this experience, we've just realized how incredibly broad and incredibly wealthy the space is as a conversation starter.
Yeah, it's actually sometimes felt bigger than us.
Mm.
Yeah, it's been very overwhelming with each week,
mm.
knowing that there's so much to talk about, but it's so crucial how it's framed,
mm.
because in a way, everyone has spoken for this already.
It's true.
It's almost like, yeah, everyone knows everything about it,
yeah.
in some sense, because it's a part of our everyday life,
yeah.
you know, domestic
yeah.
workers and domestic
yeah.
work.
Yeah, and I just think also having to deal with, you know, everyone, it's that rare space where everyone has a personal experience.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that I found so amazing, is every time we tell someone about it, or every time someone tells us about it, they speak on such personal terms. I don't know how many domestic workers' names we know now.
Exactly. And hasn't it just become a lot of counseling?
Yeah.
And we're constantly having to rein conversations in, and not even just on air. I mean, we'll meet somebody random, maybe a friend or a friend of a friend who has listened to the shows. And they'll want to give us feedback, which we welcome.
Yeah.
But feedback then turns into like a 45-minute therapy session.
One of the things that I find quite curious actually is, you know, often like with a celebrity or someone on air, if people give them feedback, they'll give them as the individual feedback. But people never give us feedback. They give the topic feedback. And that is what I really enjoy, is like that, you know, that there's such a personal resonance with the listeners that they can only talk about the topic. So we're almost, you know, invisible in the conversation, which I like, because I sort of hope that that's what we frame it as. It's invisible enough for everyone's contributions to be as meaningful as the next.
You know, and it's such a healing process for everyone. I think what I didn't realize would be our role is one of counselor.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
And it's heavy, isn't it?
It's incredibly heavy, because I think we have our own personal misgivings about this space and this role.
Yeah.
You know, and then everyone always wants to open up, and people seek reassurance.
Yeah, they want to.
And it's so hard, because I want to tell them they're okay, and I want to be able to create, you know, definitely a safe space for them, but also to reassure them that like everyone in this space is fumbling, because they're you know, it's a hot mess. But at the same time, it's difficult to do that, and it's difficult to give them a soft landing.
Yeah.
Because it is a hot mess of a space. We started off only with the intention to speak and to engage with the domestic worker experience.
Yeah.
Right? And we were going to be inclusive in that process, but we were definitely going to have every conversation from that perspective. But I think this space has invited so many different perspectives, and not just on domestic work, but on human beings, on our society, on power, on all kinds of things that these women observe, on intimacy, on shucks, any number of shows that we've done that have been about other things, right? We had a taxi driver in here once, and he schooled us on the taxi industry, and from simply being a passenger in a taxi, right, we were able to make a domestic worker a part of that show.
Yeah.
And that's what's been daunting, is to realize the infinite scope of what we're doing, because these women have such an omnipresence, you know?
Yeah. What I've also found quite interesting to learn in this process was how things that are sort of framed as very sadistic when seen as ideas are actually so vulnerable, you know, and so delicate. And the things that exist out of fear that becomes power, actually when you really address it and when you look it in the face, is still something extremely vulnerable and delicate.
Mm.
And then how do you deal with that? Because it is powerful, but it's powerful in being delicate.
Mm.
How do you navigate that?
It's crazy. But I do like that. You know, I think we've become guerrilla warriors in the sense that in guerrilla warfare, the whole idea is to turn your weaknesses into strengths.
Yeah.
You know, and that's something we speculated about, but we've seen it constantly.
Yeah.
Proven to be true.
Yeah.
And I think even our own insecurity coming into this, and just being amateurs and being naive and idealistic and ignorant, you know, has made this a much more organic process. And we certainly hope that you can feel that. On our podcast, you know, we're still getting comfortable in this space, and we're changing our minds, and we're changing our approach every single day, and we're actually evolving as people, and we're coming in and out of confidence all the time.
I mean, one of the interesting things that we did, which was completely out of both Mbali's and I's comfort zone, because we're both introverts, but we try to do like
Why you gotta expose me like that, girl?
So we thought, let's just
My name is Mali, and I'm an introvert.
Hi, my name is Talisa. I am also an introvert.
But I feel like you...
We don't know what we're thinking.
No idea.
But we thought to do a marketing push for the show. So we thought, let's go into, you know, real space. So like in town, we went to Braamfontein. And we decided to approach people. We even had war paint on our faces.
I was dressed in full domestic worker uniform, right? But it was like from a music video. I could have been in a hip-hop music video.
Yeah, she looked very swagged out.
I looked very, very swaggy. It was so gangster. Yeah,
you were like the prettiest domestic worker I've ever seen.
Oh my God, I was the prettiest girl in Braam. What do you mean?
And she had a broom and everything.
I was so hot. I was so hot.
But it literally felt like after approaching even like 5 people, we were so emotionally exhausted because it was just so out of our comfort zones. I mean, you know, introverts actually lose energy by engaging too much with people. Mm. They have to sort of limit how much they engage with people.
You see, Talisa's more consistent than I am. So she's very self-preservational, right? So she paces herself incredibly well. So she's not ever too high or too low. Occasionally she'll get excited, but she'll rein it in. Right? Because she understands she's an introvert. And so she's very, very easily drained by human interaction. I, on the other hand,
yeah,
so carried away.
So we had decided that I will talk and she'll hold the banner. But literally with the very first person, Bunny was on it. She like ran forward and she did most of the talking.
For about an hour and a half, literally I just was running on adrenaline talking to every single person. Outperforming myself. And then what happened? I crashed.
I crashed, yeah.
But like I crashed hard. Like Talisa was the only man left standing, which is often the case. I don't know why I do this.
So yeah, that was like once we did that and then we just couldn't do it. It's just so out of our
So talk about some of the things we realized through that exercise, right? Because what did we think going into it? I guess I thought people would be
more engaging.
More engaging.
Yeah.
I guess I thought if we had a mic and we had a sign that said "Made Sessions for Cliff Central" and we had our question on the sign, you know, and there was something like quite charming, I think, and quirky about what we were doing.
And it was Women's Day.
Exactly. Yeah. That people in Braamfontein particularly.
Yeah.
You know,
everyone's
the woke people.
Everyone's trying to be on TV there as well.
The woke people in Braamfontein would be thoroughly engaging. And the way we were avoided, the way we ended up having to like chase people down the street.
Yeah. And that was also very hard because
it was so uncomfortable.
Because shy people are not trying to chase anyone.
It was so uncomfortable.
So overall, it was just really out of our comfort zones. And that's also, I think, what made us realize how invested we are in this, that we were so willing to get so out of our comfort zones to make this movement.
Yeah.
I'm always scared to say movement.
Revolution. Just say it, girl.
But to bring it to the fore and to have really sincere and legitimate conversations with a wider audience.
Mm. And I think we found that like people are skeptical to get into the conversation because nobody feels like an authority. Nobody is.
Yeah.
And there's also this kind of latent guilt, I think, that we all feel as employers of domestic workers. You know, even the best of employers take liberties, to put it mildly, right? There's just things inherently in the space that are norms, right? That are commonplace, that are still not quite right. Yeah. You know, the only thing worse than discussing some of the conditions these women work in, the only thing worse than that is actually having to be them.
Yeah.
And to go through those things firsthand. Mm. So the fact that even the conversation is so precious.
Yeah.
Is a little bit ironic. It's like, you know, if the fact that these women themselves who go through this on a daily basis have had more courage in talking about this than people who can engage it from a distance is a bit weird. Unless, like I was saying earlier, there is this latent guilt where everyone feels culpable in a sense, or having to admit to themselves, finally face the reality of the relationships they have with their domestic workers, because we, as people, for some reason, we feel like if we make something a sacred cow, or if we shy from talking about something, if we make it taboo or we make it an uncomfortable topic and we don't engage in it, for some reason, it creates in our heads the illusion it doesn't exist.
But things never stop growing, even though it's silent.
Yeah.
So, and I guess that's why it's so hard to talk about it, because, you know, things have been growing onto something that's just so fundamentally flawed.
Yeah. Dear Madam, for instance, so just to, okay, move on to a different exercise.
We've done so many.
A different exercise we did is we put out an open letter from the ladies we've worked with. We helped them to put it together, but we were essentially scribes in the process. And that was it. It was a sincere letter from them about their experiences. It was an open letter to South African madams. And mind you, we are all madams. So, you know, nobody can divorce themselves from that role. I know we think of madams as white women in particular, but really anyone in South Africa who is a domestic worker plays the role of madam, right? So it was an open letter to all of us, I guess, in that sense. And, you know, we touched on very, very real, but quite hardcore things as well, in the sense that I think they were jarring for a lot of people to face. So we tried to do it with an element of humor, and it read very easily, and I think they wanted to write it in good spirits, and they wanted it to be constructive and loving, which I think it was, and also funny.
But it was also the sort of humor that they told us the stories with.
Exactly.
Exactly.
There's a saying, something like bitter medicine goes down well with a spoonful of sugar. I feel like that's what we tried to do.
Yeah.
And yet, even for the most kind of open-minded of people, and bravest of people, and most progressive around us, it was a very uncomfortable read.
Yeah.
You know, because we touched on domestic workers washing underwear, their relationships with pets.
Medicine.
Medical aid. We touched on baiting, you know, how employers sometimes play this game of hide and seek to try and check if domestic workers are doing their job. So they'll hide things in strange places. We touched on things like leave. We touched on maternity leave in particular, which a lot of domestic workers don't get. Privacy we touched on. And, you know, even for employers who I think consider themselves very humane and consider themselves to be doing right by their domestic workers, it was uncomfortable, and they almost didn't want to talk about it. So where do we go from there?
and this has actually been a personal frustration of mine, is I feel like we're receiving so little feedback.
We'll get likes. We know people support the movement. We know people listen.
Yeah.
But for some reason,
So in a way, we don't quite know, because this is supposed to be guided by collective responses, you know, because this is for all of us.
Mm.
So to not get, you know, the feedback that I think is very necessary for something that's so personal to so many, it's so hard to navigate the ship. I mean, you know, even from but even from a personal point of view, you know, I don't have a domestic worker. I've never had one. My family has never had one. So it's very difficult for me to know how to do this if I don't get feedback from those that are personally grappling with these topics.
So it's been a strange combination, right? Of very intimate feedback.
Oh, yeah.
And then nothing. No feedback at all.
But the fact that there's no in-betweens is such a reflection on the importance of the topic.
Yeah. But there's certainly not been a lack of interest, and for that we would like to thank you, but we just want you to be a little bit more forthcoming.
But not for 45 minutes.
But not for 45 minutes. Is that okay? What are some of your greatest lessons learned so far?
What I have found very humbling is how you don't have to make excuses for bad behavior based on where you come from, you know, because a lot of the women that we've met, and bad behavior is maybe even the wrong way to term it. Mm. But like the women that we've met, they will speak about such dehumanizing situations mm. that they're going, that they'll go through as soon as they get home after our conversation. Mm. And yet, if you ask them anything about what you would do to the family if you were a bit more powerful, if you had money, if you got out of the situation and you had the opportunity to do something, what would you do? And it's always from such a place of love that they speak. Mm. And sometimes I wonder, is it you know, Stockholm syndrome in mm. a way? And I'm not sure, but I've always felt like they actually speak from such a place of love that they always see the other person's humanity no matter what. Mm. And so if there's a fault on their part, they see it from the perspective that all humans are gravely flawed mm. and we're all gravely conditioned, and that there's just an air of forgiveness, or with the ladies that we've spoken to. Mm, mm. And I personally find it very humbling, because I have had so many frustrations surrounding race and surrounding, you know, and I'm a lecturer, and like having to deal with the decolonization conversations, and I have so much frustration, you know, or like the Black Lives Matter movement. And sometimes I get so afraid that I'll become a product of that frustration and that helplessness. So it's so amazing
yes.
to see.
I absolutely those love women. What you've said, because I think in our minds, we build forgiveness up.
Yeah.
To be something bigger mm. than a sentiment or a feeling or an attitude, right? Because we intellectualize, I think, and take stock of all of the wrongs.
Yeah.
You know? And whilst we should do that with a view to fix things, I think that the gravity of those things does not have to arrest forgiveness.
Mm. Or make you the thing that angers you. Mm. But you know what's also very interesting about that situation is that they practice loving their perpetrator, so to speak.
Yeah.
I say that in inverted commas. So, you know, they do still raise a lot of people's children. In order to raise a child, you have to have some sort of love for them. And that's yeah. a practicing of love. And so even though they can be in a situation where that child disrespects them, or that child acts like their boss.
Yeah.
You know, it makes that situation very interesting, because you get to practice forgiveness because you're practicing love.
Yeah.
And I think in certain situations regarding marginalization, that's not often the case.
Yeah.
You're not practicing to love yeah. the thing that is hurting you.
Yeah.
So where do you practice forgiveness?
No.
Like, you know how they say that the person that hurts you often forgets what they've done, but that the person that is hurt, you know, takes much longer to forget.
Mm.
They have to go through the
yeah,
process
you
of
see,
healing.
Exactly. So this
stuff.
Is the distinction between forgiveness and forgetting.
Yes.
I think forgiveness can and should happen a lot faster than forgetting. The trouble is
yeah.
when you've forgiven people, right, if you find it in yourself,
mm.
then often they forget, and you feel like you should forget as well. Whereas the what still needs to be dealt with.
Yeah.
And worked through.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think it's important to, it's incredibly important to forgive, but not to forget. Why I say it's important to forgive is I think it makes the process of healing and progress mm. a more expedient and a more constructive one.
Mm.
You know what I mean? If you mm. approach progress with a feeling of forgiveness,
mm.
right? The mm. outcome is likely to be less vengeful and more, and just to make the world better.
But you know when where forgiveness is hard is when the hurt is constant.
Yeah.
But the action of hurting
yes,
the person is
exactly,
constant.
Exactly.
So, and that's again like the role that I think a lot of these ladies find themselves in, is that it's so constant. Mm. It's an everyday thing.
So that's
thing.
What makes it particularly profound, right?
Yeah, definitely.
It's not like forgiving the past.
Yeah.
It's forgiving your everyday.
Yeah, it's a constant
experience.
Practice. Yeah. But you know, at the same time, then I wonder, like, when do you get to demand that something must stop, you know? And when do you get to do that on terms where you're not threatened because you're in a position less powerful? And that's very difficult, you know? And that's why I really admire their ability to forgive. But then sometimes I wonder, is forgiveness their only option and their only means of staying sane in a condition that is horrible for some? Not for all, but for some.
It's incredibly difficult to work out. I mean, I think on that note, what I've learned is just how much pain and stigma arrests value.
Yeah.
And a lot of these women have had to set themselves aside as individuals, as human beings with aspirations and who want to explore themselves and their talents and express themselves and who want to achieve.
Mm.
They've had to set themselves aside in that sense to and tune out all of their inalienable rights to want something better. They've had to tune that out to face their circumstances.
They've done that for something that they often see as temporary.
Yeah.
Which is also so deeply saddening, is that so many thought that it would be a few years, some even a few months, that they would be there until they found another job or found a way to pursue their dream or found a way to study, got married.
It's the dreaming. It's the dreaming that guts me the most. It's the dreaming and it's the talent that guts me the most. You know what I mean? So, and the two kind of work hand in hand, right?
Yeah.
A combination of dreaming and talent is largely what leads to success.
Yeah.
And the pursuit of happiness.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, inherent belief. Yeah. It's like it's the first stepping stone.
You are stuck in a situation that is so rife with stigma and people constantly undermining you that it's too painful to dream or to be talented. Can you imagine feeling stuck in the job of a domestic worker if you had a talent and a dream, but purely from a material point of view, couldn't get out because you had to support your family or because things didn't work out for some other reason.
I mean, there might be like a potential neuroscientist cleaning your floor right now.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so how much human capital do we waste in that sense?
Absolutely.
And that's the inherent problem with any role that becomes an identity. So we cannot load people's roles with classism and with prejudice and with indignity, you know?
Yeah.
We can't.
Yeah. You know, when you're offered an identity in spite of what you know you are, you know, because your narrative's already written, people refer to you through your stigma.
It's maddening.
Yeah.
Maddening. And the only way to survive that is to numb yourself and numb any part of yourself that exists outside of your work.
So do you think forgiveness is a form of numbing?
Yeah.
Oh, that is crazy.
Because if you had to be angry, you'd be defiant. You know what I mean? It's difficult to be angry in a void.
Yeah.
Without it leading to some kind of action of sorts or defiance. You know? It's almost like the two go hand in hand. It must be excruciating to be angry and then not act.
Yeah.
Anger needs physical expression. It just does.
And it also sucks when anger feels like your anger and action and actioning that anger feels like your only option. And it's something that is so outside of your natural self, you know? And that you then start to be, you start to get defined by your reactive behaviors rather than your actual ones.
Sure.
I think what we're trying to do with the mess is bring it to light because it's festering, you know, and it's not helping us to pretend.
We're
going to
expose the mess.
Yeah, exactly.
We're
going to
expose the mess.
Exactly.
And we're going to try very hard to put the mess in perspective. And we're going to try to involve everyone in a process of figuring out what to do with the mess.
Yeah, and we want you to know that we're terrified at all times.
Always.
So
never not.
Yeah, we're not necessarily leading the pack, you know, with any sort of profound knowledge that anyone else doesn't have. So that's why we really insist on feedback, because we do appreciate it. I mean, I think all of our human experiences are really important in this process.
It's also an exciting space if you think about, there's very few demographics, or there's very few spaces in our society that are kind of unrealized and undiscovered. You know?
It's a gold mine.
It's a gold mine. The problem with, and this is why I love turning weaknesses into strengths, because that's what's so exciting, is that it's so rare in this 21st century of ours, where things just happen so rapidly, you know, and they grow exponentially, to find markets and spaces that are not saturated.
Yeah. Have you ever thought, Bali, that people just won't want to, you know, listen to us because you're not like the Kardashians or trying to tell them the latest trend?
No, not really. And I like this idea. So basically, if markets and spaces and creative spaces are saturated, right, you've got to find alternative ways to create value. And so, to answer your question about the Kardashians, I think...
Who I love, by the way.
Oh, listen.
Personally, yes.
The greatest guilty indulgence. I think those types of figures in our society are inaccessible to people. As much as we feel like we have access to them, we don't. And they're we do maybe on social media, and we have access to information on their lives, but not to them as people.
Yeah.
Which makes them unrelatable. And I love how relatable we are and in this space, right? Because I think it creates a different type of icon.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Right? She's one who exists at grassroots and in the real world.
Yeah. But you know what? What is accessible about the Kardashians is aspiration. You know, is... And it's so interesting, because with aspiration, it almost feels like the story to, you know, success, whatever people deem success as, is irrelevant. You know, it's the final outcome is enough. So, and because everyone can aspire to some form of success, even the ones that are stigmatized and stifled in dreaming and thinking beyond themselves, there's still some form of aspirational quality in their thinking.
Yet, that is all the good stuff we miss out on. I would love to... That's not what you see on Keeping Up with the Kardashians, right?
Yeah.
If you follow that story since the sex tape with Ray J came out. I would like a lot more of kind of the raw vulnerability and the fumbling that goes into the process
of
creating an icon.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Not just the glitz and the glamour that they show. And look, they do try and keep it real.
Yeah.
But we also know it's not that real.
It's so scripted, yeah.
You know, it's incredibly scripted. And there's something they're trying to portray. And they're definitely, for me, probably the most interesting parts of their story have been left out, you know?
Yeah.
The days when they're not glamorous, or they don't feel like it. Or the days when the truth comes out about, you know, who has ulterior motives in the process? Whose fame is it anyway?
Yeah.
Or really? What did they all want to be? I want to know what they wanted to be before they were Kardashians. You know, I want to know what happened to those dreams. Yeah. I want to know all of that stuff. And the beauty with taking a story like one of a domestic worker and taking people through every step of her emancipation. If a domestic worker tomorrow becomes Kim Kardashian, but for some reason, through the maid sessions, it'll be a more relatable story.
We're the backstory.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then people can choose whether or not they want that, because we don't know the sacrifices that Kim has made. We don't know what she cries about at night.
But I guess what I definitely do like about the maid sessions is that it's, in a way, tracking a success story, but from one of the most difficult positions that you can get success.
Absolutely. This is a rejected space. And I don't mean the kind of rejected in Hollywood where you wait and you go to auditions for like 5 years and then eventually you get a break. No. This is like pure unadulterated rejection. So rejected, in fact, that you are cleaning up what people reject.
Yeah.
It's like an extra layer of rejection. Nothing could be more rejected than this space. It follows then that the process won't miss a beat in terms of tracking the unfolding of a human experience or a human condition, which we don't get, unfortunately, with a lot of the more iconic stories that we follow in the world, you know? So that's what I like about this, because rest assured, I mean, these women are going to be great.
Because they already are.
Because they already are. Yeah, exactly.
It's just being, it's just made public.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I look forward to the future politicians, you know, the heads of state, the entrepreneurs in the world coming from a sudden awakening of the value that, the secret value that lies in spaces such as these, you know, because it's the people we least engage that are the most engaged.
Ooh.
It's the people who are in a position to observe because we overlook them.
Yeah.
Right? And we treat them as though they're invisible. While we're busy plugged into our silos, you know, and our unilateral engagements, they're seeing everything. It's like, for instance, when you're not driving, if you take public transport and you look out the window, you really see the world. Yeah. It's a completely different experience.
So true.
Success 2.0.
Yep.
Aspiration 2.0. Everyone is going to be like, oh, hell. You know, I want to be undermined too. No one will see me coming. No one will see me coming. Please undermine me. Actually, I beg.
Yeah, we should make t-shirts.
We should. Please undermine me. Don't disrespect me.
Undermine me.
Undermine me. So thanks for listening to us waffling about.
Indulging us.
Our experience so far in the mate sessions. It's only going to get bigger and better, and you'll realize at some point that this was a turning point. So we did feel like we had to share the very raw experience that we've had and the thoughts in our heads right now before we embark on our second phase, and we're excited about that, what that will be. And we also will always appreciate the early adopters, and that is all of you listening right now. You're 100% firmly the early adopters, and we have mad respect for you. So yes, thank you for joining us on the Mate Sessions with Cliff Central and on this journey as a whole. And we look forward to so much more ahead of us, Talisa.
Yeah, from my side, I want to say thank you as a foreigner, because I still psychologically feel like a foreigner in this country because I don't culturally relate. And so I want to thank you for sort of allowing me to be in a very South African space in a way. You know, it's it hasn't been easy, and sometimes I've wondered if I'm trading over waters that I'm sort of not allowed to be in.
Well, on the other hand, I am a South African.
And you give me permission?
No. I can sometimes feel like a counter-revolutionary, right? Because what I'm questioning is our practices and the way that we live in our society and the decisions we make. Mm. And much of decisions my family's made as well, and the ways in which we've lived.
Yeah.
You see? Mm. So that also is difficult.
Very interesting.
But people have been very accommodating and very engaging.
Yeah, absolutely.
So in general, thank you.
Yeah, that's actually really all that's left to say is thank you so much for all the support that you've given us. And we really, really hope that we'll see a lot more of your faces and engage you guys more in person, because that'll be, I think, very useful in general to the topic. Yeah.
The revolution. Say it.
God.
What am I going to do with you?
Revolutions happen. They are just, you know, said. I don't know. I wonder if I'll jinx it.
No, it's affirmation. It's already happening. You know what I mean? It just now is about gravity. But really, everything we've done from the start, I will say it, has always been in some way revolutionary. And I'm proud of that.
I'm proud of what we've done, no matter what it's called.
Yeah, and by no means is it you and I, you know?
Yeah.
It's everyone who has been involved with us in this journey.
Mm.
So, yes, the revolution
is here. Please make sure to follow us on Twitter at Made Project. That's MAIDE Project, as well as our Facebook page. Just type in Made Project as well, and you'll find it. It's called The Made Sessions. Have a very lovely evening. Thank you so much, and goodbye.
Cliff Central. The revolution. I've got something important to tell you. CliffCentral.com.